Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm delighted to have on the show today Dr. Arthur Groton. Art is a life member of the American Philatelic Society and a member of the Postal History Society of America, as well as a fellow of the Royal Philatelic Society in London. He has served as president of several collectors' organizations, including the Ephemeral Society of America, the Postal Label Study Group, and the Poster Stamp Collectors Club, the last of which he founded himself. He's known among his fellow collectors as a researcher who has published on subjects ranging from a study on the censorship of Napoleon Bonaparte's mail on St. Helena. That study grew out of an exhibit that he curated here at Vassar College some years back, as well as the first in-depth study of the U.S. permit imprint system. He's here to talk with us about the collection of poster stamps he has assembled over the years and now generously given to the Vassar Libraries, a selection of which is currently on display in the Vassar Art Library through December 16th. Welcome, Art.
How are you?
I'm good. It's great you could come. We'll be talking about poster stamps, and people may not know what a poster stamp is. I didn't know, actually, before I visited your home and saw your collection. So can you give our listeners an idea of what a poster stamp is?
Poster stamps had their origin as small format promotional labels for exhibitions, either national, regional, international, or local, usually related to commerce and industry. Mm-hmm. There were some for art shows. These became more common later. The earliest of the exhibitions goes back to 1855 in London.
That's not long after the postage stamp, the legal postage stamp is invented.
That's correct. The postage stamp itself, that is the thing that you use to mail letters with, first was developed by Sir Rowland Hill in England and issued in 1840. Mm-hmm. We didn't have stamps in this country until 1847. So postage stamps are called that because they look like stamps, mm-hmm. but they're not. They have no franking privilege. They were primarily promotional.
Yeah.
And in the early days, of course, they were relatively pedestrian in design. It isn't until the end of the 19th century that the designs become much more florid. Mm-hmm. And it was soon determined that these little pieces of paper were quite good as a medium for advertising, mm-hmm. and not just promoting shows and exhibitions. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of the 20th century is when poster stamps really became a serious form of advertising. And the word poster, of course, comes from the fact that many were small renditions of the full-size posters that were put up on walls. Uh-huh. But they were not collected in the same way that stamps were because they were too big. So these smaller format graphics were used on envelopes. Uh-huh. You would put them on the outside of the envelope so that someone would see what you're promoting. If you were a manufacturer, then starting in 1898 at the Leipzig Fair, there was a space at the bottom of the official stamp to put your own imprint for your company, and there are about 480 different. So that was the beginning of promoters seeing the value of these stamps.
These, just to give people an idea of what they look like postage stamps a bit, but they're a bit larger?
They vary in size. They tend to be an inch by an inch and a quarter to about an inch and a half by 2 inches. They usually have gum mm-hmm. on the back of them, just like stamps do. They're usually perforated, which means it's easy to separate them from the sheet, mm-hmm. if everybody remembers the old days when they had perforated stamps and not these pull-off, stick-on labels they use nowadays. And they were produced primarily by lithography. And if you go to the library and you look at some of the stamps with six or eight different colors, you can imagine the exquisite technique that was required to make them. There are a few known that are engraved. Those were usually made by the either the American Banknote Company or Perkins Bacon in Britain to demonstrate their work. They were very expensive and hardly used privately.
What strikes me about them is they're incredibly beautiful. That's not my experience of most postage stamps. Either the newer ones, like you say, the peel-off ones that tend to have colors in them, but older ones also, they're incredibly colorful, they tend to be. And even those that aren't colorful, just one or two colors, are very striking in terms of the artistry that went into them.
Well, that's part of the definition of what a postage stamp is. There are postage stamps and there are seals and labels. If you think about TB seals or Red Cross seals, those designs tend to be pedestrian.
Yeah.
Although some of them were done by the great artists, but for the most part, they're pretty boring. Most charitable seals are. Postage stamps did, however, find use as charitable seals, particularly in the First World War. And those also have some quite remarkable designs, both graphically and semiotically.
Yeah.
In the Second World War, of course, we all know the patriotic labels, but they're not terribly interesting.
Yeah.
So a postage stamp, I'm going to read a definition that Charles M. Price, who was a noted chronicler of the postage scene at the end of the 19th century, this is what he said about postage stamps. It must have a clear simplicity of motive and a vigorous yet sometimes bizarre conception in design and treatment. It must first catch the eye, and having caught it, hold the gaze and incite further though brief inspection. The advertisement, which is the reason for its existence, must be conveyed directly, clearly, and pictorially. It must be well designed, well colored, well printed, and well drawn, and these qualifications are stated in the order of their importance. Above all, the design, chic, bizarre, an inspiration, a flash of thought in the brain pan, flaring up in a blaze of line and color, however short-lived. It should be pyrotechnic and should depend for its impression, like a rocket, upon the rushing flight of its motion and the brilliant, even if momentary, surprise of its explosion. And the stamps that are currently on view demonstrate these points extremely well. You look at them and you just stop and you say, oh, wow.
Yeah, they are. They're small, but they do really catch your eye and pull you in. And they all seem to have a single kind of message that makes itself felt.
Well, the interesting thing about the whole use of postage stamps, and there were more postage stamp collectors than there were stamp collectors in that first decade, up until the First World War. And there were thousands of clubs, even in this country, and extremely popular. They were the single most important form of advertising in pre-World War I Germany, in Wilhelmine Germany, because the Germans came much later than the French or even the British and Italians to color advertising and to the use of graphics in their magazines and newspapers. So by 1913, in Germany alone, there were 50,000 face different stamps. I say face different because some of them were produced in multiple colors.
Mm-hmm.
They were highly collectible, and they can be collected topically. That is, I want all the cats.
Yeah.
Thematically, I want anything to do with cats, including cat food.
Yeah.
Or hometowns. And the interesting thing about the postage stamps is they're very often collected quite provincially, which is to say that you won't find Berlin postage stamps in Munich and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, same is true in this country. Denver stamps occur in Denver, New York in New York. And there's an obvious reason for that, is just the geographic proximity.
If the Germans came late to this, late to color advertising, when they did come to it, they came to it in a big way, didn't they? Because most of our stamps, I would say, at least half of them are German. German and Austrian, the ones we have out, even the earlier ones, advertising the exhibitions. And as examples of graphic art, they're really wonderful. They're technically, especially. There are major artists that are working in this medium.
Well, the great German graphic designers, as well as the Italians and the French and the Dutch, either their posters were miniaturized or they were hired to make these stamps specifically. And so that there are very definite national styles. And this can also be seen in the exhibit in the library, which is maybe 0.00% of what actually exists. But it will give you some idea of the breadth of the kind of stamp, as well as the difference in the national styles. Now, most of the stamps shown in the exhibit are German, British, or U.S.
Yeah.
There are French, And you can almost close your eyes and say, oh, yeah, that's French. Oh, you know, that's German.
Yeah.
There are a number of Austrian secessionist stamps, mm-hmm. highly sought after. The only stamp known by Egon Schiele is in this exhibit. So it's a microcosm. The collection that I donated is 7,000 different stamps. And probably half of them, at least, are identified as to who the artist was that did them. So it's a great repository for graphic design between, say, 1890 and 1940.
Yeah.
So that students can really find the, you know, a tremendous amount of interesting information.
You can see in them various styles very strongly. I mean, post-impressionist or deco stamps. There's a secessionist style. You can see there are Art Nouveau and even Beaux-Arts, some of the earlier stamps.
And
surrealism even. I mean,
oh, yeah, a few of them, but yes. You look at that and say, what is that? But there is in the library now a book called The Art of the Postage Stamp, Volume 1, Germany, which is written by my friend Nick Follinsby, who's an MFA. And has been collecting postage stamps for years, and he evaluates the stamps in terms of their style. Mm-hmm. So he traces the different Germanic styles, and the other countries will come later.
Yeah. And then the major artists were pulled into this.
Ludwig Holbein, probably the greatest of the German posterists. You had Lucian Bernhardt, Oppenheimer, Dietz, Deutsch. I mean, it's endless, and similarly there's Capiello and Cassandra. There's a wealth of the great designers, but many of the stamps that are quite spectacular, we don't know who designed them.
Yeah.
And the fellows in Germany have been studying these things and looking through auction catalogs and so on and so forth for 50 years, and they just haven't found some of the designers.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, it's very, very hard. For breadth of design type, you have them here in the collection. Ludwig Holbein mm-hmm. was unsurpassed,
yeah.
And I think I had 90 or so that you now have mm-hmm. out of the 120 or so that he did. Leonardo Capiello's designs are fabulous.
Yeah.
Cassandra did maybe 10 or 12, but we just found a new one last year. Believe it or not, René Lalique did a stamp.
Yeah.
Absolutely fabulous. It's just monochromatic and brown, but it is an absolutely fabulous.
So these are crossing national schools.
Yes, I like what I like, and
like
it doesn't. And you know, I love this stuff from the from Art Deco from the 1925 exhibition.
I didn't see any Italian stamps that I didn't like. I have to say.
They were amazing.
Yes.
And you know, again, the interesting thing is we don't know. Most people aren't very familiar with the Italian artists, but when you look at them, it's obvious that it's Italian.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's crossover to French, and you're not sure is it French or Italian.
Yeah.
But it's very hard. You know, if you told me pick one stamp to take, and I couldn't.
So what brought you to start collecting them yourself?
Well, I've been collecting various things since I was 8, primarily a stamp collector and then now a postal historian.
So you have the gene, the collector's gene.
Yeah, you're either born with it, you either have it or you don't. And so I was at a stamp show one day and I couldn't find anything for any of my collections. So I sat down at a friend's table and I said, Roger, show me something I haven't seen before. And so he took out a book, and they had some postage stamps in it. I said, oh, what are these? And he said, well, they're postage stamps. I don't know what those are, but I like them. So I bought, about $100 worth, just of the ones that I liked. I knew nothing about them, the ones that appealed to me graphically. And basically, that's how I built my collection, is those that appeal to me. I am not a trained art historian.
Mm-hmm.
I just know what I like. And that's the lovely thing about this is that you can collect whatever you want.
Yeah.
Nobody can say you're wrong.
Yeah, there were so many produced, which is rather amazing.
Yeah. And new ones are being found to this day.
Yes,
some of the big companies like Tobler or Nestle or the British Railways would create series of stamps
mm-hmm.
that would come out every month or so, and you would go and get the stamps, and then they would supply the albums that you went and put them in.
Mm-hmm.
And these were aimed at children
mm-hmm.
to go either get their parents to buy the product
yeah.
or to go around to the stores, draw them into the stores to see the products. It was highly effective.
So in a way, then, they're a way of building a community of customers, aren't they?
Yes, you would bring people in, but the people did not necessarily know that other people were collecting them. But there were societies, as I said, but very little is known about them. Unlike the philatelic societies, many of which are still in existence after 100 and something years. The old postage stamp societies or their bulletins don't exist. Yeah. So we don't know the extent to which people in Munich going to the different stores would have gotten together to trade and talk about the stamps. We just don't know.
So would individuals have put these on their correspondence to just to sort of identify themselves with certain products, say?
Or? Either because they liked it, they liked the design, or the companies would use them. But you find many of these on envelopes unrelated to the company that's promoting the stamp. Yeah. They could also be used on letterheads. Theoretically, it wasn't legal to put the stamp on the front of a cover. Oh. It had to be on the back. But we find them on the front a lot.
I'm wondering, in a way, if they're working as a kind of social media where you're just letting your friends know you like Buster Brown shoes or that...
Well, that's I never thought of that, but I could certainly see that that would be something that a private individual would say, look, I tried this product. This is a great product. You should try it. The ones that I've seen tend not to be put on randomly. That is, it just you'll never find a stamp from Britain used in the States or vice versa. But it's an interesting concept, and I think that that would be a wonderful project for somebody to take on.
Okay, well, that's just the thing. There's so little research on this medium. I've looked, and you know, there's some. There's a little bit, mostly, you know, in German, but not that much. And given the kind of social history that you can see in them immediately just looking at them when you see a collection, it seems to me they're just a gold mine waiting to be looked at. And there are media historians like Lisa Gittleman who argue that forms of printing that fall outside traditional scholarly study offer rich and untapped material resource for historical and cultural studies. And this seems to me to just fit the bill perfectly in that. You know, Vassar has a tradition of that with our own historian Lucy Maynard Salmon used to collect at the beginning of the 20th century, just as these stamps actually are being produced. I'm starting to wonder now if she may poster stamps, but you know, she collected recipes, she collected cookbooks, she collected train tickets and railroad schedules and that kind of thing, because she knew that students could use them as primary resources to do their own research in history and what, you know, what we'd call now ethnographic studies. And she built up archives of these things.
Well, she was, like Bella Landauer in New York, a pioneer. Nobody was doing that, and that's why so much of this material is rare, because nobody saved it. That's why it's called ephemera.
Yeah. Given how many of these were produced and how popular they were, I mean, this was the form of advertising for a couple of decades anyway, it's amazing how little is known about them and how they have just sort of slipped into our cultural amnesia into oblivion. It's actually an instructive thing to think about for a few minutes, how easily things that we take for granted around us, things that might be records for others, you know, down the road of who we are or who we were, do just vanish into nothing.
And that is one of the reasons why I've been very gratified over the last few years to see major museums, when they have their big exhibitions, no longer ignore the mundane. The ephemera is there, whether it's in the form of sketches or notebooks or what they would have thought were minor works. These things all tell part of the story, and that's something that really has only happened in the last decade. Yeah. And you can't read the New York Times nowadays, but once a week there is a major article in one of the art sections on something related to this form of ephemera, things that were meant to be thrown away.
Our own Patty Fagan, curator at the Francis Lehmann Loeb Center, is assembling an exhibition that's going to be up in a year or two on the World War I poster. And, you know, I'd seen in your collection World War I poster stamps. And
there, so, there are 20,000 or more World War I poster stamps from all over the world. It's a field of its own. Yeah. If you added up all of the pages of catalogs, it's 1,000, 2,000 pages. It's immense field.
And with the stamps, commercial stamps particularly, you could come to all kinds of conclusions about attitudes toward race, towards gender, well, place of women in society, that kind of thing.
Well, a very good friend of mine, Rachel Huner, wrote her PhD thesis and defended the use of postage stamps as her primary source. And a copy of that you have. Yeah. And she looks at the role of women in Wilhelmine Germany, as well as patriotism, specifically looking at the iconography of the Bismarck monument that was built in Leipzig in 1913. And one of the interesting things when you look at the stamps, many of them have that monument on the stamps, although it has nothing to do with the product, but it has to do with demonstrating the patriotism. We are good Germans. Mm-hmm. You know, our product is something that you should buy because we are patriotic. Mm-hmm. And this is true also if you look at something as mundane as the Imperator, which was the largest ship in the world at the time. In addition to the stamps just about the Imperator by the company, there are many, many companies that use the Imperator as a symbol of being the best. And so these kinds of uses of the stamps, I keep saying the word semiotics, but that's what it is, is something that's a wide open field for study.
Yeah, semiotics is a good word here, actually, especially, you know, think about the commercial stamps, because there's such a small field for an artist to work in, and there's a purpose to these. You know, you're not making them for no reason. You're making them because your company, you know, wants to sell products. So there's definitely a message there, and that message has to be communicated. So you've got a situation where you have a little laboratory in which you can work out the real fundamentals of what it means to sell one something visually without using a lot of words. So.
Many of the stamps have very few words.
Yeah.
Just the name
of
the company and an image, and many of these stamps come in sets. Mm-hmm. So it would be, you would start at the beginning of a story and go to the end of the story in a set of 6 or 8 or 12. And these would often be printed in sheets where each design was in the sheet rather than a whole sheet for each design. But there was a story there. And again, this prompted people to go out and look for the ones that they don't have. Mm-hmm. And later on in the game, they actually were numbered so that you knew exactly what it was you had to look for. Others use the alphabet. So they would spell Adam Opel, for instance. Nowadays, they make Opel automobiles, among other things.
Opel Cadet, I remember from the
1960s. Exactly. And he had a set of 8 stamps that spelled his name, and there were different images on each stamp of what the products were that he produced. So there were many ways that they used these. There's another thing I should mention just in passing, and that is that for folks who couldn't afford to have special stamps designed, there were what were called stock stamps. And a company would make 1,000 designs, and they would have salesmen that would go around to the small stores that couldn't afford to design their own and, you know, pick an image. So they would pick something that was relevant to their company.
Shoes, say a pair of shoes.
Exactly. And then they would have their name imprinted on the bottom to give out. So that's another interesting collecting field, is how far afield do some of these designs go, and some of them actually do cross national boundaries.
And you can see the sort of things that are being sold over a period of time. There are certain products that come to the fore, like cigarettes and
very big. And shoes, very big.
Yes, yeah.
And for some reason, heels. Shoe heels.
Yes.
I mean, there are thousands of them.
Yeah. And candy. The Germans really are into chocolate.
Candy? Oh, yeah.
So, yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So it's an endless field for both the collector and the researcher.
A number of the stamps in the collection, the earlier ones especially, are for various kinds of art exhibitions and other kinds of cultural exhibitions. The Schiele stamp is a musical affair or musical event that it's advertising. And I wonder, with those early stamps, why the genre begins with these art fairs and these art expositions. Is it just that it seemed natural, maybe, that artists would do something to advertise an exhibition, big exhibition? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think, as I said before, that the art exhibitions came several decades after the industrial and trade fairs.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that was because the technology wasn't there to do justice to the... I mean, there are several stamps done by Mucha. They're all monochromatic, and so they lose the power.
Yeah.
Similarly, Hohenstein, you know, from the late 1890s, I've only seen stamps of his that were in 2 colors, whereas the post-it themselves are in many colors. So I think that was probably part of the reason that the purely art exhibition stamps sort of held off.
Yeah. But there were the trade show stamps before this, then.
Oh, yes.
So,
oh, yeah.
I kind of was merging them in my mind, almost thinking of the Great Exhibition of 1851 and it being an arts and manufacturers sort of thing. But
exactly. So, well, you had the great explosion in postage stamps occurred first at the Belgian Fair in 1897. There are about 20 different, say, for the Columbian Exposition, 1893. Then you jumped to, as I say, the Belgian in 1897, where there were several hundred. Then you go to the Paris 1900, and there's a catalog my friend Charles Kittle put out, 5,000. The Pan Pacific Exhibition 1915 had 400 or so. So, and many of these stamps were There were official ones, the ones that were released by the exhibition itself, and then there were the private ones that exhibitors would use either to entice you to come to their booth or after the fair to say, ah, we got a gold medal. So there was a tremendous value to these stamps for both the promoters of the fair and the attendees.
I imagine people would keep them as souvenirs that they had been off to a fair somewhere.
Yes, actually, over the years that I've been collecting these, a number of collections of just, say, the Pan Pacific have been found. Somebody would go around and collect each stamp. Yeah. And that's one of the ways that we know that stamps that were not clearly issued for that fair were in fact available at that fair. So you get into the question of, well, are they fair stamps or are they not? But the point is that these kinds of specific collections are no different than the postcards or other things that people were collecting. You know, at that time. One of the interesting things about postage stamps is, unlike postage stamps, which because of its method of production, which was engraved, steel engraved, where there are a lot of states of the plate and floors and that kind of stuff. These tended not to be true in postage stamps. And so you didn't have the kind of intense collecting of minutiae that you did in postage stamp. Yeah. So that that sense of making order out of chaos, which is what a stamp collector does, is not as strong in postage stamps because of the lack of this kind of of minutiae that you can get into. Yeah. So it's get involved in collecting all of the cats you can, and that's its own thing. Yeah. You know, but everybody collects to make order out of chaos. Yeah.
Another kind of stamp that you have here, there are stamps that feature different modes of transportation for the time. So there are a lot of, I'm a pilot interested in airplanes, there are wonderful stamps with early aircraft in them, going all the way back to a few years after the Wright brothers, some of them, advertising trade shows where aircraft, I guess, were being rolled out. But also, you know, automobiles, of course, everywhere. There are stamps featuring ships, trains, dirigibles, and of course, they make really wonderful images, all these. So,
exactly.
And I wonder why so many transportation stamps. I mean, does it have to do with the fact that, you know, the stamps themselves are about circulation and advertising, when you think of it, is about that. Also, getting your message out, circulating. And these are vehicles that circulate people. It's all part of one big system of circulation that's expanding. Or
I think that that's, you know, again, this is an ideal thing for somebody to write a thesis on. But I think that it starts early on in the 1870s, I think. There is a stamp for a balloonist. And then there are some early stamps for bicycles. Ships have always been around, so you'll find those early on. But with the development of each type of transportation, the first automotive stamp that we know about is a show in Vienna in 1900. The first aviation stamp, that is of a plane, that we know about is 1906 or 1907.
I thought I saw a Blériot in one of
them. Blériots were around. I mean, he was a highly dangerous plane, but they were extremely popular. Yeah. And there are many stamps related to the aviation shows, the exhibitions and the competitions. And that's an interesting history that I'm personally interested in, because I can mention somebody that nobody's ever heard of and should look up, and that's Harriet Quimby. Harriet Quimby was the first woman in the United States to get her pilot's license, number 37, issued by the French international organization that did that before it became individually national. She was also the first woman to fly solo across the English Channel, and she did it the hard way, unlike Blériot, against the wind. She was the darling of the United States in 1911, 1912. This is a beautiful woman who was intrepid. She was like a Nellie Bly, and she went everywhere. She was a photographer. She went all around the world taking photographs. She worked for Leslie's magazine and became fascinated with aviation, learned how to fly, got her license, flew competitively, and unfortunately was killed in 1912 in July, and all America mourned. And that was, in a sense, the end of those great competitive exhibition. The great national exhibitions it was like people, their hearts just, you know. So there are interesting things that you can cull from these, you know, images. And in fact, there is a postage stamp of Harriet Quimby that was done by Jungen Magazine who had her photograph on the front of their, or actually it was a painting, on the front of one of their magazines, you know, on the cover. And it's a very famous image of Quimby. So, I mean, and there is a postage stamp of that. Yeah. So it's you know, you would look at it and say, ah, who is that? But it's amazing what you can learn from these things that you had no idea.
Yeah, what was, the reputations are as ephemeral as a stamp.
Yes, I guess that's true.
So another kind of stamp that seems to have been very popular, we don't have them in the exhibit. Obviously, sports stamps were popular. Advertising major sporting events, including the Olympics.
The first Olympic stamp was with the first Olympics. As a matter of fact, there was one prior to that when the Olympic Committee was formed in what is it, 1894, mm-hmm. they issued a seal. Well, you know, remember, sports in the pre-war era, you had the cigarette cards and then bubblegum cards, and sports sold things. And so besides the manufacture of sports equipment, there would be the use of sports as a mechanism for promoting the good health of their product. Interestingly enough, though, unlike the cards, the sports stamps, at least prior to World War I, did not feature specific sports figures. After the war, the German sports magazine had a series of basically reproductions of their covers, and they would have Olympics and rowing and cycling and running and that kind of stuff. Yeah. And these would be the fellas who won the awards. So after that period, you can find stamps for specific winners.
We talked about commercial stamps and fairs and the art shows. A lot of these stamps, though, were issued as propaganda stamps after World War I, weren't they?
In addition to patriotics, which I'll come back to in a minute, there were all kinds of charity stamps. When in the 1906 volcano, Etna, there was a stamp issued in Chicago, a triangular stamp, which is really quite beautiful. It's three colors. Comes in two types. And so that's quite a remarkable thing. And there were a number of stamps like that for specific events. Then, of course, you had the anti-tuberculosis and the Red Cross, and they're endless, and they're still being made today. During the First World War, the designs were, for many of those stamps, quite striking. Not what we would call seals. They're a step above that, maybe not quite as high up as a postage stamp, but halfway in between. There were patriotic stamps going back to 1860. The earliest known in the United States is 1860, and that was in support of Fremont's run for the presidency. There was one for Queen Victoria in 1845 for her visit to Scotland with Prince Albert. So there were those stamps. There were stamps made for the sanitary fairs held during the Civil War. There were patriotic labels for the Civil War, both the Union and patriotic. And I wrote major work on those. Maybe there are maybe 120 from the Union and 20 from the Confederacy. And then the next big event was the Spanish-American War, of which there are a lot from Spain, maybe 30 or so from the United States. And then once the First World War started, then there was this tremendous explosion of patriotic stamps throughout the world. In the United States, even before we entered the war, there were, and you can also find, of course, stamps in the United States for the German societies prior to the time that the Americans entered the war. So they were not considered the enemies. And so, yes, they were selling the Free Press out of Omaha, I think. There were a lot of stamps for relief, tremendous number of stamps for the post-World War One relief. You have the Depression stamps, the stamps for the bonus, the fellows who wanted to get their World War One bonus early.
There were several stamps issued.
I talked about that on History Channel a few years ago. So you had all of these quasi-national stamps, really more charity labels and seals, but they fit into that whole patriotic a spectrum from great designs to not great designs. And then, of course, there's a big explosion in the Second World War. But postage stamps basically died out just before the Second World War. And they're still being made. There were some made post-war by some of the better French and Swiss designers. The German ones, the American ones, tend to be pedestrian, British ones, after the war. They're still made. If you look on envelopes, you'll still find them, you know, stuck on for various trade shows. So there was a period of great quiescence between 1940 and the pickup of interest again in the mid-90s. when Tommy Steele wrote a book called Lick 'em, Stick 'em, just illustrating the Samson. He divided it by topic. And so that sort of brought it back. And my dear friend Walter Schmidt sort of carried the torch for 30 years by himself, just writing a one-man, you know, 8-page newsletter every month. Mm. And then when I got interested in my good friend Charles Kittle in England, then we formed the Postage Stamp Collectors Club, and it's become more mainstream.
So you were in the vanguard of this.
Of the new, yes, of the of the new, of the new group, yeah, yeah. And the interesting thing is, because these things are called Cinderellas, yes, because they look like stamps, but they're not stamps, and the stamp collectors wouldn't allow them to come to the ball. Yes, this is a snobbishness that persisted for 100 years. Now there is an exhibiting field, competitive exhibiting, for Cinderellas.
Yeah.
And some wonderful exhibits have been put out of either artistic styles or expositions.
Yeah. Interesting you should talk about snobbishness like that, because, you know, generally from my perspective, as someone who actually does very much what you do, except I get paid for it, I collect things that have to do with the present and the past so that people have them in the future to think about and to work with. But from the point of view of the Academy, stamp collectors were always thought to be Cinderellas. So I find it refreshing that we're coming together here, because, you know, we do have this common struggle we're in the war against oblivion, and we're all trying to make order out of chaos in order to do this, because, as you know, as a collector, it isn't just about finding things and keeping them. It's about making sense of them.
That's
and
right.
Providing
it's something. Otherwise, it's an accumulation.
Right,
it's not a collection.
Right. It's just a pile of paper and ink.
Right,
so.
Right, right. Well, the interesting thing is, I've been an iconoclast in the philatelic world for 30 years, mm-hmm. and I drive philatelists crazy mm-hmm. by telling them that the ultimate ephemera is a stamp. Because ephemera is something that it's meant to be used, its value is gone, mm-hmm. it's tossed away.
Yes.
If you write a letter, what's important about the letter? It's not the envelope it went in, it's not the stamp that was put on it, it's not the seal on it, it's the contents. Mm-hmm. The contents are what's key. So stamps have served their purpose. They have no intrinsic value once they've been canceled. They're only valuable because we collect them.
So a young girl out there, 11, 10 years old, who's starting her first stamp collection, I think she should be able to regard herself as a researcher, in a sense, and, you know, helping to add to the store of knowledge we'll all have in the future of those
things. Well, you know, there is a whole field of collecting, as I've mentioned before, which is topical or thematic. Now, thematic collecting is much more challenging, and it's the way that many new collectors are coming into the hobby.
Yeah.
The great collections of classic stamps, nobody can afford them anymore, the 19th century. Mm-hmm. 20th century is now coming into its own. It's being, especially awards are now available for even post-1980. Mm-hmm. There are studies to be done. Mm-hmm. But when you look at stamps for children, if you can find someone who are interested in collecting them, they usually are going to collect them because of the image that's on them. Mm-hmm. And that was not true when I was growing up. We were filling spaces. Mm-hmm. There are albums now, but not the way they used to be. And there are too many stamps. An album for every stamp in the world would take 8 linear feet, probably.
Yeah, I collected pennies, you know, when I was 7 or 8. And, you know, they used to be books where there was a slot for every year.
That's right. And the SP and the S and the P's.
SPDs. No one ever had them because there were only, you know 30 coins produced for that year. But you know, I did have all the nickel pennies, you know, pennies made out of nickel that were produced during the war because they wanted the copper for wiring.
That's right.
Do you have any advice for someone who might be interested in poster stamps and might be interested in starting a collection?
Well, certainly at Vassar, take the time to look at the exhibit and then to go look at the collection. Just wander through it. Don't necessarily go, well, I'm only going to look at the German or the French. It's not that big. It's 9 volumes. I forget how many. But you can flip through the pages and get a sense for what there is, and something will speak to you. When people ask me, what are you going to collect? I don't know until I see it.
Yes.
But if you wanted to collect poster stamps, there is the Postage Stamp Collectors Club, and we do have a website. Mm-hmm. It's www.postagestampcc.org.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of information there. There are other sites. If you Google poster stamps, it will come up on the top, and then there are a bunch of other sites. And that's really the best way to get started. Find a mentor who can help you get over some of the hurdles that new collectors often have.
Yeah.
And poster stamps are not terribly expensive. The rare ones, like everything else, are, but most are not, and perfectly within the reach of any.
Yeah, I've seen them on eBay for sometimes $10, $15 a piece.
Or less.
Yes.
Or less. It depends on what they are. Yeah. And there are over 100,000 on eBay, I think, listed. It's a huge number, and more being put on every single day. I think everybody should collect something. We all collect something, you know. We just don't recognize it.
No. No, there is something about, I remember my first collection was, I was 4 years old, and I remember pulling rocks out of the yard, in the backyard, that had been broken for some reason. There were just a couple of them, broken in half, but they were both halves there, and you could fit them together. Mm-hmm. And somehow I saw this was something unique, and I would take them into my room and put them in a cardboard box that I kept under my bed. That was my first collection.
So
there is something that drives us to do this.
My grandsons come and take all of the gravel out of my driveway and put it in boxes, and then when they leave, because they never take it with them, I go out and put it back so they can do it again.
Yeah, same thing. I should start a club with them, a stone collectors club, So I'd like to thank you, Art, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about poster stamps.
My pleasure.